Blog Talk Radio.
What if you were wearing something sexy? What if you were drinking? What if you made the first move? No matter what, sexual assault is never your fault. Support is available 24/7 through the National Sexual Assault Hotline. Call 1-800-656-HOPE or visit RAIN.org. That's RAINN.org. This is Christina Ricci with RAIN, reminding you, it's never your fault.
Brought to you by RAIN and this station.
Good morning, and welcome to Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. I'm your host, Joy Keys. I want to thank you so much for tuning in. You can follow me on Twitter at Joy Keys. Also, check me out on Facebook, Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys, and on Instagram, Saturdays with Joy Keys. Also, I encourage you to check us out on Spotify, Stitcher, iTunes, iHeartRadio, Amazon Music, as well as here at Blog Talk Radio. Wow, I'm going to be speaking with a person who is a writer, a broadcaster, an editor. She was a deputy editor of BONA, hosted Night Talk on Radio 702 and Breaking Dawn on Newsroom Africa. She's also won National Arts Festival and Business Arts Silver Award for Feature Writing and Media, led 24 Legends Columnist of the Year. This is Guguletu Mushungu. I hope I pronounced your last name correctly. Good morning. Good evening for you.
Hi, Joy. Yes, you pronounced it correctly. Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be on with you.
Thank you so much for coming on and making time. I know that you're very busy. You're all the way across in South Africa right now. There's a lot of drama going on there with the Jacob Zuma. How are you handling that as a person and then also as a media, a broadcaster?
Yeah, so it's been quite a tumultuous few days. I think it's been like about 9 days now for the country. Obviously, the former president being imprisoned for 15 months because of his contempt of court after refusing to comply with the subpoena to appear before. We have a commission at the moment that's looking into allegations of high-ranking public officials using their position to benefit private individuals. It's called the State Capture Commission, and the former president was implicated. So there was already quite a lot of talk around will he or will he not be arrested. And, of course, for the governing party, that's going through a very difficult time because it's highly factionalized. So there are very big ideological splits within the governing party. Its secretary general has also been suspended and came out as a supporter of the former president. And then, you know, when he was imprisoned, when he then handed himself over to begin serving his 15-month sentence, there was quite a lot of, well, not a great deal, but his supporters certainly took to the streets. And that's when we saw protests in KZN, which is the province the former president is from, and continues to enjoy a great deal of support, but also in the economic hub of the country, a province called Gauteng. And it's, yeah, it's been a really difficult, stressful time. Yesterday we heard again from our president, Cyril Ramaphosa, saying what may have started out as quite localized protests around the president seems to have also been in some way co-opted by people looking to destabilize the country, which has been a great concern, and also questions around, you know, state security says they gave this information to the police and they seem to have not acted on it. So quite a, you know, quite a lot happened. And also discussions around poverty and inequality, as we've seen, you know, people looting for basics, you know, basic foodstuffs, because South Africa does have quite a high poverty rate. We're at about 64% of South Africans are poor. One in five live in poverty.
And that's something that you talk about that in your book. And let me ask you, how do you think women are faring right now with the Zuma situation? Because, you know, he was accused in the past of, you know, assaulting a young woman. What do you think is happening with poor women now with this destabilization?
Yeah. So, I mean, before COVID and obviously the economic impact of the pandemic, women in South Africa weren't in the best of places. Particularly black women, they remain the most impoverished. The poverty rate among black South Africans is closer to 80%. women being the group with the highest, a black woman being the group with the highest rate of poverty and unemployment. Just a few days ago, I was looking at a statistic that said domestic workers, one in four of them, haven't returned to work since our first lockdown in March of 2020. And that means, so not only are women in ultra-low paying jobs work, many of them are now without work. So we're still trying to figure out what the impact of the pandemic has been, but it's undisputed that the impact on black women, poor black women, has been immeasurable because they were in such a vulnerable and precarious position before. And because so many of the jobs that have been disrupted by the lockdowns, by the restrictions on large gatherings are predominantly done by women, that in and of itself has had quite a large impact. So certainly the last 16 months have been devastating for everyone, but especially for poor black women who already were, you know, on the back foot socioeconomically prior to last year.
Tell the audience a little bit about your book, just in a brief, like, couple sentences. What is your book about?
So my book is called You Have Struck a Rock, Women Fighting for Their Power in South Africa. And it really tries to examine what some of the material conditions of young women or South African women right now. So, for instance, I look at what it means to be a domestic worker in South Africa, because there's about 1 million women, predominantly poor black women, who work as domestic workers, but they are some of the least paid, the lowest paid workers in our economy. Hence I use the phrase ultra-low wage workers. They only get two-thirds of the minimum wage, and the minimum wage is already quite low. It's not a living wage. So the book looks at specific areas and what it means to be a woman, so women and land, women and equality. I look at sex work. I look at gender-based violence. I look at physical autonomy and how some of those things actually connect with history. So again, to return to domestic workers, I actually speak to a unionist who herself was a domestic worker 4 decades ago and became a unionist accidentally. And it was interesting to speak to Mamini Zadla because she's very interesting overview of what she saw when she started as a unionist in the late 70s, early 80s, to the challenges that prevail right now in 2021, issues of, you know, low payment, you know, poor working conditions, physical and sexual abuse being quite endemic. So the book looks at some of the challenges now, but also traces the line of history, how history impacts on some of those challenges as well.
Yes. Now, you start out in the first chapter, you talk about truth and reconciliation, and one of the things that you notice in your research is that they were not really focusing on what was happening to women, and that women were telling everybody else's story and not their own story. Can you tell the audience why that was, what you found out about that, why they weren't telling their stories?
So the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was, I mean, around the world is quite lauded for the way in which it attempted to make sense of South Africa's past and the way in which it prioritized restorative justice versus retribution. And it was an imperfect process, but I thought it was so useful to look at, even in the process of trying to make sense of the years between 1960 and 1994, what if the TRC learned that in 2021, that could be useful for any of us trying to make sense of history. So the TRC begins its work to try and figure out what were some of the experiences of people living in South Africa in 1960 to 1904. And the reason we use 1960 is in that year, it was quite an important year. It saw the banning of all political parties, but specifically the ANC, which later became the governing party, and the PAC. And so because it couldn't look at all of the years of apartheid, it looked at those 44 years. And once it began to look at that work, it found that women were coming to the commission to give testimony about what had happened, about arrests, abductions by the state, about forced removal. but very seldom will women come into the commission to speak about what has happened to them. So, for instance, Joy would come to the commission and speak about what had happened to their partner or their children or their neighbor or a colleague or someone that they've worked with. But very seldom did women come to the TRC and say, this is what happened to me. And as the TRC began its work, it found that in as much as women had stories of other people, they themselves had been victims of abduction, of forced removals. In fact, the face of a lot of the apartheid policy was black, poor, and female. And so the TRC then figured out that they needed to be quite deliberate in looking for the stories from women about what was your experience, you know, in the period that's being examined. What did you experience? What did you hear? What did you see? And there was quite great work done by the Center for Applied Legal Studies at one of our universities that said, if we are to really figure out what happened in apartheid, we have to be deliberate about asking women to share their experiences. And I thought, and I went back to the women hearing, and I thought it was very useful as a way to start the work, as a way to show why I was writing the book. To say we must be very deliberate about asking women to tell their stories, to ask what happened to you, what did you experience?
The same thing in America, and I think around the globe, you know, women are silenced for so long that they themselves think that that's the norm and like their issues aren't important. And you bring that up about in your book about, you know, the issue of sexual assault, like it's just normal. Let's talk about this issue of gender and land. There was a very important story that you talked about. I hope I'm pronouncing the name right. Mashabel Mary Rahube. And she had a groundbreaking case. Tell the audience about that case and what it meant for women in the past and also going forward.
So a few years ago, I became aware of the story of Mama Mary Rahube. She was, by this time, an elderly woman who was in the South African courts attempting to not be kicked out of her home that she had lived in for decades with her children because of her brother attempting to evict her. Now, previously, under the apartheid dispensation, black women were not able to attain legal status. So you were either a child in your father's home, a sexual minor in your husband's home. As a result, women couldn't own land or housing. If there was a piece of land, there was a house and a family, the title would automatically be given to the male in the home. In this instance, it went to Mary Rahube's brother, who then, he didn't live in the house for many, many years. He then comes back and then decides he wants her evicted. He even challenges this on the basis that it is discriminatory, because in South Africa, you may not discriminate on the basis of age, gender, sex, sexual orientation, religion, pregnancy. So she challenges this because the law that he was using to evict her did discriminate against her on the basis of being black and female. The matter goes all the way to our apex court, the Constitutional Court. The Constitutional Court finds that this particular bit of legislation, which was a relic from apartheid, was unconstitutional because it meant that women could be discriminated against and not be able to have or continue to live in homes that they'd lived in their entire lives or with their family. And so it was struck down. The challenge with Mama Mary's story is even though she was now able to have that first part done away with, I actually spoke to two of the lawyers that worked on her case, and they said she may still very well need to go to court to get the eviction prevented, because she did was prevent the first part, which was her brother saying he was allowed to kick her out because he was the title holder. That was the first part. But she still needs to go to court and fight to be allowed to stay in her home. And I think Mama Mary is in her 80s now. And she's but one of many women who, because of the previous dispensation, may live in homes, but they don't own them. They weren't able to own them because women weren't allowed to legally become adults. And that's just one manifestation of some of the challenges around women in South Africa and holding property. But I also look at other parts of the world because, unfortunately, this is a global phenomenon where even the UN on the right to housing finds that women often lose their homes because a partner dies, so your husband will pass away, and you are then shipped out of your home by family or the community, or your husband passes away and suddenly the person that owns the house is no longer there, but you as a woman are not allowed to own the house. So it is interesting to see, while this is quite a big problem in South Africa, it is a global challenge. And there's been, you know, legislation enacted. I think one of the examples I use is the Tanzanian Village Act, which said that women may not be kicked out of the home following the passing of their husbands, because that is such a routine, such a normative thing, a thing that happens all the time.
So it's crazy because, her story was like, you know, one of the best ones because it changed the law. But one of the things you talked about is that people didn't even know the law was changed. Your other chapter is dealing with sex workers. Really horrific story of this woman, Kumalo, by, I guess he was a public figure. Can you tell the audience about that story? Because that really was like, when I read the details, I'm like, my stomach kind of like, I'm like, ah, you know.
Yeah. So a few years ago, I was still quite a young journal working at a newspaper, and the story broke of now convicted murderer Zindi Mthethwa, that he had been accused of the murder of a sex worker in Cape Town. He had been accused of beating her to death in the early hours of the morning in the Western Cape, one of our provinces in a city called Cape Town. And I remember reading Nopila Kumalo's story and feeling just devastated by her story, A, about the manner in which she had died, and it was also very clear that her being a sex worker was quite a large part to public response, because after the news broke, there seemed to be this great hesitancy to believe that someone as celebrated, as well-regarded, as wealthy as Mthethwa would murder a sex worker, but also because South Africa is a deeply religious and conservative country, there was this kind of sense of, well, you know, because she was a sex worker, you know, these things happen. And the story really came.
Not like this, though. Not like the way he did it. The way he did it was so malicious and evil is the word I would put to it, because it was like, what did this human do to you that you're going to stomp her like this, you know? It was really, really horrific. But one of the best things that you talk about in the book, one of the people you had spoken to research, it was like, just because you were tortured or you have trauma, that doesn't give you an alibi to do torture and trauma to someone else. I really, really appreciate that comment, because a lot of times, as you say in the book, people are like, oh, well, you know, this happened to him when he was little, his parents beat him, and he was an orphan, and this, that, and the other. So, you know, that's why it happened. But what? No, you can't. No, you have a choice.
Yeah.
At a certain point, you have a choice, you know, about your behavior. Go ahead.
And I was going to say, you know, the part of why I quoted that bit was about how, you know, one's own trauma does not, you know, create an alibi to traumatize someone else or to harm someone else, is because, especially, again, for Black women, and this is across the world, because of the history that, you know, of patriarchy, of white supremacy, Black women not only endure patriarchy, but we too endure racial injustice. Women, you know, women endure homophobia, women endure, and yet, you know, women aren't socialized to believe that we can harm one another in the ways I think men and boys are often allowed to or socialized to believe they can behave. And so I thought that was very important, especially with, you know, young women who identify with feminism, especially intersectional feminism, many of us thinking about, in what ways do, even though I endure harm, how do I enact harm or trauma based on, you know, sexuality or class or, you know, and I thought that was very important. And I make the point about children. I think children's rights are an integral part of, you know, the work of liberating people everywhere. We can't say we want to be free but want the right to harm children. And that challenges many of us. It's the thing Bell Hooks writes about in her book All About Love, which I refer to, where she says she knows many people who are staunch, you know, radicals. They are
Can you repeat what you just said?
Sorry,
you kind of fell out. Yes,
oh,
go ahead.
Sorry.
I was saying,
you know, if I say children's rights are an important part of, I think, feminism or feminist work, because we can't say we want to be free but want to harm children. And it is the thing Bell Hooks writes about in All About Love, which I refer to in the book as well, where she says she knows many people who are anti-gender-based violence, who are anti-patriarchy, but want the right to harm children. But, you know, we can't claim to want to be free but want to harm others, including children, who very often have no rights.
The same thing here,
yeah,
you know, with the corporal punishment, I can do what I want with it.
Yeah.
I have many friends who were brought up and said, oh, man, I got tons of beatings, you know, but I'm okay now. And it's like, what? You know, we wouldn't allow somebody to do that to an adult. So the issues are the LGBTQI issues, trans issues, and you have a discussion with Beverly Dixie. I had her on the show talking about those issues. And one of the things that is interesting and happens, again, globally, I think that's the issue. We need to see that this is a global issue. Women in the movement, trans people, the LGBTQI, are secondary at all to the political movement of free black people, you know?
Yeah.
I thought that is really helpful. I think that this is why your book is important, because you're talking about history, you're talking about present day, but you're also talking about globally so that people can see you're not alone in this. This is a patriarchal situation. You are not alone in this. One of the things is the domestic workers issue, and you talk about women who are domestic workers. I've really had a hard time. The lady worked there for 20 years. And then this incident happened. Can you tell the audience about this particular woman? She worked at a family for 20 years and then this incident. Could you tell them about that?
Yeah, so one of the big challenges and why I actually wanted to look at the experience of domestic workers is domestic workers are at the intersection of so many of South Africa and I guess the world's challenges. So on one hand, they have to deal with patriarchy, so the fact that they are women, they are discriminated against, so they are harmed on the basis of their gender. The fact that they are poor workers, there's also a level of violence and harm that they experience because of the fact that laborers, which again is, you know, connected to the history of the country, but again the history of the world. And so with domestic workers, there's this terrible working conditions where, in addition to, you know, undignified, long hours, low pay, there is the reality of violence just being a part of day-to-day life for domestic workers in South Africa. And there were just, when I spoke to various unions who are working in the space, there were these horrific stories of women being abused by their employers. In fact, the Easy Domestic Workers Alliance that I speak to one of their founders, they actually started because there was a case of a woman who had been assaulted unconscious by her male employer. And so, we always have stories of women who are being abused. And there was the story of a woman who'd worked for 20 years for a family, raised their son. And a few years ago, the boy, assaulted her. She was then in court, to testify against this boy that she says, you know, because she raised him, she thought of him as a son, but he assaulted her. And that's just one example. And I remember reading that story and being so heartbroken because it was just another example of, you know, the difficult lives domestic workers have as women, as workers, as, and it all happens, and it, there's just this confluence of all of these challenges for this very vulnerable group. I also point out, despite there being a million domestic workers, they have very little protection, including, I make the case for immigrant domestic workers, undocumented migrants working in the country from different parts of the continent, endure additional violence because, and this is one of the things one of the unions said to me, they
the
know,
same
well,
thing,
employers know that.
The same thing happens here, you know, Latino workers coming from Mexico, Russian from different parts of Europe, Eastern European workers coming, and they're not documented, and the people feel they can do whatever. I mean, we've had stories here in America where, like, they're being kept in the base, and their passport one are held by the owners of the house. Heartbreaking in your book was, you know, blacks working whites, but now blacks work for blacks and other who are continuing the cycle of treating these women so horribly, you know? Let me ask you this.
Yeah.
How long did you write the book?
How long?
Mm-hmm.
How long did I write the book?
No, how long did it take? Was it like a year, 6 months? How long did it take the book?
So I completed the bulk of the book last year. So the bulk of the work and the research happened during sort of the middle bit of 2020. I think it was also just a great way to keep my mind focused on anything but the pandemic. It was great to have something just to focus on. I had to read, I had to write, I had to interview, I had to transcribe. But I really started thinking about the book probably 4 years ago. I've always been interested in, you know, what does it look like when we deliberately gender South Africa's history? Because I've always felt that was missing. You know, coming up next month of National Women's Day. But outside of that, you don't really talk about women's history. So if I'm honest, I've been thinking about the book for probably a good 4 years, but the bulk of it, and started writing some of it, the bulk of it happened last year.
What was the hardest part for you? Because I know there's so many, I guess, heartbreaking stories, but you do have some positives that come about. But what was the hardest part for you in writing this book?
I think, you know, being a woman in South Africa, having experienced some of the things I write about, like intimate partner violence, like the failure of policing, you know, patriarchy, I knew things were difficult. I knew we had a great deal of work to do to achieve. I mean, one of the South Africa's founding values is non-sexism, along with non-racialism. But I think one of the most difficult things was, once I started the research, is really getting to grips with just how bad some of the things were. I'll give you an example. Many years ago, there was an organization founded, and I refer to them, called the 1 in 9 Campaign. They were created to support the woman who'd come forward about being sexually assaulted by the former president. She made the allegations, the matter went to court, and she was treated horrifically, so much so that she had to go into hiding. But where the 1 in 9 Campaign got its name from was, there used to be a study by the South African Medical Research Council that found that only 1 in 9 rapes that occur in South Africa are reported to police. And I went back to the 1 in 9 Campaign and spoke to them, and they said to me they believe those numbers have actually worsened. I then went and researched the South African Medical Research Council data findings, and it's true. The number is no longer 1 in 9 rapes that occur are reported. It's that 1 in 25 rapes that occur are reported. And that's a heartbreaking that, you know, the situation is worse. It was heartbreaking to speak to the unionist. In her 40 years of working as a unionist around domestic worker issues, she said to me, apartheid is alive and well in South African suburbs because the way that domestic workers are being treated is so bad. And so that was really difficult for me, reading the stats, reading the research, speaking to people that are work, who are doing the work, and just getting a real sense of just how difficult, how much work is to be done. I did feel a bit despondent at times, but I also say, I think this is a complete nut, in the face of all of that, I was also quite inspired by the great sense of community, great sense of, all of the people I spoke to have a real strong sense of justice, that things don't need to be the way they are, things can be better. And they doing this work. And so while it was difficult, I was really also genuinely edified by speaking to the people I spoke to because they believe things can be different. They believe, you know, we can all be free, we can all be safe. And that for me, I think, it was hard to hear some of what they're working with. But I also think that was quite an important part is that it doesn't need to be this way and we are not alone. Which is the thing I think that we are not alone. Let me ask you this.
What's something that you learned that you didn't know about? Like, what's something that surprised you? Maybe something even positive, because we have a lot of bad stuff. Was there anything positive that just really surprised you and you didn't know about in your research?
I think so. One of the reasons I started writing this book was about the women of the Federation of South Africa. It was the country's first interracial national organization that prioritized women's issues. And so once I started writing the chapter, I started doing a lot of research about them. And they crafted something called the Women's Charter in 1950, in the early 50s, which it was the dark of apartheid. And it was so interesting to see some of the demands of the charter. You know, they demand, for instance, that women be given the same rights as men, to be unencumbered by, you know, not being able to hold land, have their own bank accounts, or choose what work they wanted to do. And it was so interesting to see, you know, the thread of women's activism from, you know, it'll be 65 years since that march. But it's so interesting to see, you know, many of the things young women are demanding now, there's a long history of that. And I thought that was really interesting. And even speaking to, you know, I did a chat on a woman called Ruby Juarez. She is the first woman to be elected political organization head in the country. And it's just so interesting to read about her because there's very little about her in our history book, which is why I thought to find out about her. So it was just interesting to find these pockets of history that show that women have been organizing, demanding, marching around these issues, which I think for young women is important because I think for many of us, certainly for me, it's easy to feel, I think, isolated, to feel like, you know, the thing you are asking for is new or, you know, but, you know, you have decades of history, decades of, you know, other women doing the work. And so that was interesting for me, reading about the women in Duncan Village who organized the political gathering under the guise of a religious gathering, because political gatherings were banned, but you could host a religious gathering. So the women of the Methodist Women's Guild organized this huge anti-apartheid gathering under the guise of a religious gathering. And I thought that was so interesting. You know, it's one of the biggest anti-apartheid gatherings, but we know so little about it.
One of the other cool things was the beauty contest, that they had beauty contests that were originally thought for just, you know, whites, but that was another way of connecting with women. I mean, we really have to be creative when you're coming up against these systems. And again, same thing here in America, you know, women are fighting, but they have to be creative about how they do it because, you know, unfortunately, just like you talk about in your book, the police, which is where you want to go for help, are maybe the place where you can't go for help because they are also committing crimes against women. And that's something that's not talked about, especially here in America. We talk about young black men being stopped by the police, being brutalized, maybe being, quote-unquote, to be they committed suicide. But there is not a lot of talk about women being stopped and being sexually assaulted by police. And sometimes they're not even kept. They're let go, but they were sexually assaulted. And you don't hear the stories. And you can't tell me it's not happening, because we know it happens because women talk about it, but not in this open arena of the news. You don't hear that. You hear about somebody being beaten or hung, but never, nothing about a sexual assault. And that is a double, like we were talking about, it's like a double thing for women. You, so you get stopped because you're black, but then because you're a woman and the male police officer stopping you, you get assaulted. Okay, let's stop talking about all this crazy negative stuff. What is this thing about Dumbledore in the streets and what's his name, Voldemort in the sheets? Are you a Harry Potter addict? What is going on here?
I am. So, you know, Harry Potter came out, I think I must have been in primary school. So much of my childhood was spent reading the books way too, and we had to wait a little bit longer because we didn't get them when they came out in North America or in Europe. But yeah, I'm a huge Harry Potter fan. It seems, you know, the last couple of years having to reckon, for instance, with J.K. Rowling and her very harmful ideas around trans women. But yeah, I mean, grew up on Harry Potter, got immersed in that universe. And so a few years ago, I think I've had that bio for probably, I think, a good 10 years now. I don't know where I saw it, but I really loved it, about Dumbledore in the streets, Voldemort in the streets. So I use it everywhere.
You also have a Beyonce thing. You have Beyonce all over your Instagram. Is this your, like, woman crush thing? Like, do you have any crushes on the other women? Like, what's the connection with Beyonce? Why do you like her so much?
I think, you know, I wasn't always a Beyonce fan. I liked Destiny's Child because, again, they were amazing and their music was fantastic. And, you know, they released, I remember one of the first albums I ever got was The Writings on the Wall, which I think was their second album. And I loved it, and they were so cool. And it was that moment of girl groups. So you had Black, you had 702, you had TLC, you had Destiny's Child, and it was just, you had the Spice Girls and Girl Power. It was just so cool. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and then Beyonce went solo, and I thought, hang on, there's something here. And I remember I became a stan. Like, I joined the Beehive after watching the I Am Sasha Fierce World Tour. I got the DVD, and I just couldn't believe how incredible she was on stage. And I just, since then, and I've seen her 3 times in concert. And yeah, I think she's incredible. She is, you know, she's the epitome of just, like, hard work and grit and, you know, just really putting in the work and being tireless. So, yeah.
I'll agree with you. I agree with you.
Yeah,
because, I took my daughter to
incredible.
See Beyonce. Yeah, I took my daughter to see Beyonce. It was raining. And when I say it was raining, at first it was like raining a little bit, but then it started pouring. They did not cancel the concert, and Beyonce came out, and she gave, like, all of herself. Like, I was like, wow. And I was not a big Beyonce fan. I took my daughter there for her. It was like for her birthday or something. And people were screaming. They knew all the lines. People taking pictures, huge screens and everything. And like one example was they had a water. They had the floor was water. They made like almost a mini pool.
Yeah.
And the dancers were dancing in the water. And it was pouring rain. Okay. So I'm with you on the Beyonce. Well, we've come down to the end of our interview here. What is up next for you? Do you see yourself writing another book? You have a working at a magazine. What's up for next for you?
You know, as I was writing this book, I was already thinking about my next book because writing is hard. I think writing is one of the most difficult things I've ever done. But there's so there's so much, I think, especially with a country like South Africa, just writing this book, there was so much I didn't get to because of time, because, you know, a book is only so long. So I would like, this is the first of many, that's for sure. I was already, you know, as I was writing, I remember talking to my publisher and saying, you know, I have this idea about, you know, looking at South Africa and, you know, our history around alcohol and what that tells us. I'm really fascinated about that. I'm really keen to tell the story. You know, there were people who are still political prisoners in South Africa, but because they come from a different political party, they didn't get, I guess, asylum or pardons when the dispensation changed. So I'm quite interested in that story of, you know, what does it mean to be a political prisoner in a democratic country and people don't know about you? So they love, I think South Africa's interesting in that there's so many stories that still, I think, remain to be told. I have a background in TV. I did TV production at university. I would like to do film.
Maybe a documentary.
Documentaries. I'd like to do. I'm also a culture journalist. I'm really interested in, you know, what culture and entertainment and what that tells us about, you know, society right now. I think it's such an interesting way to look at society. So there's a lot of stuff on my list. Also, because I really like filling my time with work.
Well, I hope you get some relaxation in. And I hope after all this COVID drama and Zuma drama and all kinds of stuff that we can get a little bit of peace somewhere in the world, because we got the weather drama, we got politic drama, we got, you know, disease drama. So please take a moment to relax. And I hope you come back on. I would love to have you back on the show to talk about whatever your next book is or your film is, you know, so we can have to discuss those new projects of yours. But thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. It's been so great talking to you.
All right. Well, you take it easy. You have a great evening, because it's evening there for you, and a great weekend, okay?
Thank you so much. You too, Joy. Keep well.
Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you, everybody, for tuning in. I just got off the phone with Gugu Leitu Mushungu. She's a writer, broadcaster, editor. She's held positions as deputy editor of BONA, hosted Night Talk on Radio 702, and Break Dawn on Newsroom Africa. We just got off the phone talking about her book. I'm going to be giving away some copies of her book, so you want to follow me on Twitter, at Joy Keys. Also, you want to check me out on Facebook, Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys, and on Instagram, Saturdays with Joy Keys. Her book is called You Have Struck a Rock, Women Fighting for Their Power in South Africa. Awesome read, really awesome read. You're going to learn so much from that and also get inspired about other women and what they're doing around the globe and in South Africa to, you know, push women's rights ahead. You guys have a great weekend, and I'll see you next week. And thank you so much for supporting the show.
Adopt US Kids presents What to Expect When You're Expecting a Teenager, Learning the Lingo.
GOAT. G-O-A-T, acronym, stands for Greatest of All Time, as in spaghetti sandwiches for dinner. They're my fave. Dad, you're the GOAT.
You don't have to speak teen to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will love you just the same. Visit AdoptUSKids.org, brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt U.S. Kids, and the Ad Council.